I'm Don Hodson, and this is an oral history interview for the Eastern Wyoming College Bicentennial Project. The date is August 28, 1975. I'm visiting with Mrs. Catherine Albrandt, a veteran Wyoming, who was an early homesteader along with her husband to the veteran area. Mrs. Albrandt, would you mind giving me your full name, please?
Catherine Albrand. My husband's name is Herman Albrand.
Okay. When were you born, Mrs. Albrand?
1902.
And whereabouts were you born?
Laurel, Montana.
Laurel, Montana. Mrs. Albrand, you currently live, what, 2 miles, about approximately 2 miles north of Veteran right now?
A mile.
It's a mile. Okay. This is not your original homestead, though,
no.
Is that correct?
Our original homestead was 4 miles, mile and a half north of Veteran, and 2.5 west. And it was the homestead unit number was 217.
Ms. Albrandt, were you married when you
came
as a homesteader?
I was married, and we had a daughter that was 1.5 years old.
And where did you come from before you were here?
Before we came here, our daughter was born at Wellington, Colorado. My husband was raised at Fort Collins. And then we lived on the farm at Wellington, Colorado. And then we moved to Gearing, Nebraska.
Now, you had been farming, you say, in Colorado.
Yes.
And then in Gearing?
In Gearing, we lived in town. And he worked at the sugar factory.
What interested you or motivated you to come to this area of Wyoming to homestead?
Well, the mister didn't like to work for anybody else, and he worked for the sugar factory. And when this project was opened, he heard about it, so he thought, well, he had nothing to lose. He'd go and file on a homestead, which he did. And as I don't know whether it was luck or what, we always thought we were better off if we'd never homesteaded.
Now, you mentioned this project, meaning the veteran project.
The veteran homestead project. And so when he got his number that he had one of the units, why he came down up here and looked at it, and it was pretty sick when he got home. He said, I don't know whether we ever want to go and homestead down there, because all I've seen was prairie, and the farm next to ours was a lake, and it had rained real hard, and it was one of the places. The one unit right east of us was just great lake in there, and he didn't know whether we should take the chance of keeping it or not. And I said, well, why not try it? We're young, we've got a long ways to go, so if we don't like it, we can always drop it. But after we stayed, the first year was pretty hard. We had no well, and Jake's L. Stuckey. He was the first one out, and he had a well, and that was a mile from our place. And we'd haul our water in the barrel, make a sled and put a barrel on it with a horse while you go and drag it home, and you'd fill the barrel as full as you could. But by the time you got it home, you had about a half a barrel, and that was our drinking water. And we managed till we got the water in the ditch when the laterals had their water in. Well, then we managed for washing to go out in the evening and dip your water out, leave it settle, and in the morning you'd strain it, and then you'd use it to wash with.
Now, you mentioned, we're talking about the Veteran Project. About how large of an area encompassed the Veteran Project?
Well, I really wouldn't know how many homesteads there really were. But I just really couldn't tell you.
Now, this was an area of land that was opened up in what year?
This was opened up right after World War I. But as we understood, they had worked 10 years before to put these laterals in canals. And when we came out, all the laterals and main ditch were in the canal. That was all in, and all the laterals from the canal around your place were all in. And that was in it. We drew it in 21, and then in 22 we came out here.
Did you come out in the spring of 1922?
We came out, the mister came out in March in 22, and I came out in April in 1922.
Now, were you some of the earliest homesteaders to come into the Veteran Project, Miss Albrand?
In this project right in here, there was one woman here before I came, and that was Mrs. Hawes. Mrs. Hawes, I think, came out in February, and I came out in April.
That was Mrs.
George Hawes.
George Hawes.
And then later on, there's different ones that came. There were very few women. It was mostly bachelors.
Now, when you came out here, do you recall, you mentioned your husband was rather bleak about your prospects when he came out and looked and returned home. What did you think after you had come out for the first time with him and looked over this prairie land?
Well, I thought it was interesting. The wild open space. When I first came here, the train came from Gearing to Yoder, was as far as the rails were laid. And so he came with a team and wagon and met me at the depot at Yoder. And the trains weren't regular then, because I worked on the railroad and section hands, and you never knew when the train would come in. So the train was supposed to be in at 1 in the afternoon, and I sat on the train in Gearing from 9 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon. And then finally the train took off, and I got to Yoder about 4 in the afternoon. And my husband had met Mr. Finch, lived north of Yoder. They was old homesteaders, just dry land. And he said, "You can't take this woman out on that prairie this time of the night." He said, "So when you come, bring her from the depot, stay here, and leave in the morning." So that's what we did. When we got, he lived 2 miles north of Yoder. That was my first night in Wyoming. And in the morning, while the snow was just, about a foot deep, but the sun came out, it was just beautiful. And so we just cut across the prairie, and there wasn't a trace of a track or a fence post or anything. You just had to kind of go by your imagination. And it all fascinated me and our little daughter. She just thought it was real fun to ride in a box wagon, which she had never been in. And that's how we cut across the prairie. And then the train didn't get through here till in October, sometime like that. They had the railroad laid. The train came into Veteran.
Was the area called Veteran when you first came?
It was named Veteran right away. It was on the maps. The maps were outlined as Veteran. It was lined out, and it really wasn't on the map that way, but the one that wanted Veteran was Hattie May. She was a nurse.
That was her full name now.
Hattie May was her full name, and she had a homestead, 2.5 miles north of Veteran. And she came out to homestead it. And she thought it'd be a good idea to name it Veteran, because all there was ex-service men. And she was a nurse in service. And she was discharged, and she claimed to a homestead. Filed one and got it. So we had a nurse, and we had about everything. We had lawyers, and we had doctors, and dentists, and But none of them practiced, you know, but we had them here. They were so thrilled about getting a homestead. But the trouble of it was, most of those people didn't make a go of it. They couldn't take hardship.
Now, did you have to be a veteran in order to homestead?
Yes.
You had to be a veteran of World War One or Spanish-American War?
The World War One.
World War One veterans. Veteran. Were only they were
and
allowed.
Only World War Ones. And that's what they all were in here. So there were not many left. And so many of them, after they had homestead, they left. So you had to be on 3 years. But you could leave in the wintertime. And so in the fall, when what little crop there was, very little, why, we'd go back down to Gearing, and the mister worked sugar factory. And then in the spring, we had to come back down to finish our proving up, which was 21 months.
So you didn't stay out here those first few winters?
No. Well, we did one winter. And it was an awful cold and hard winter. And we didn't have a car, and there was just very few that did. And one of the neighbor, bachelor, he had an old Model T. And on Christmas Eve, when we were all waiting for the mailman, but we never knew when the mailman would get here, because lots of times the train would come in at 7 at night. So several of the men, they went in to wait for the mail, because we were all anxious to get mail from home. We knew there'd be something there to eat or something. So the mister went along, and they waited till 7 o'clock till the train came in. And I never will forget the happy Christmas we had. There was a great big box the folks had sent from Gearing, and they had all kind of food in it, and candies and clothing and stuff. So I think that was one of our happiest Christmas we ever had.
Now, when you began homesteading, was there a town or a store or a post office at the location of Veteran today?
Yes. That spring, when all the homesteaders came out, we had Myers, Virgil Myers, that opened, and the store was west of the railroad track. And it's right down here. John Arden was a homesteader. And he let them use a spot there on his place to put a little store on. And they opened the first store. And then we had a post office. And then the next year we had a drugstore and a little cafe. And of course that all vanished.
Now were these buildings at that time then west of the railroad track?
All but just the drugstore was west of the railroad track. And then the drugstore opened on the east, the tracks. And then the post office opened over in there.
Now, as you look at Veteran today, you primarily see, of course, the school, McKinney's Market, and a few other houses. Did Veteran ever grow into a town of any size?
Oh, yes. We had quite a few homes. We had quite a few homes, and of course then, World War II, we had the CC camp up there, and we were on the map as 400 people.
That was with including the CC?
Uh-huh. And we had, let's see, we had quite a few homes. We had about 7 or 8 houses there, and they've just gradually moved them away. We had a lumber yard, and we had a creamery. And we had a filling station.
What then probably would have been the largest that Veteran ever got to be, excluding the CCC camp?
No, I don't think we ever had more than 60 or 75 people.
Did the homesteaders in this area do much trading over in the Yoder community? I know that was a little larger town.
Yes. If you needed quite a bit of grocery, you went to Yoder, because it was, all at once, that was a boom town, Yoder, but it didn't last long. After these homesteaders had proven up, they left. Well, then Yoder disappeared too, you know. when all these homesteaders left, and a lot of the homesteads were sold for the liquor tax. And the ones that stayed, they bought that. That's how comes many of these old timers have more than one farm. Because those men that came out here, they were young and disappointed. Some of them had poor land, was real heavy, couldn't raise crop on it. They didn't have the equipment as they have nowadays. So they just gave it up. And then those that stayed, most of them bought delinquish tax.
How frequently did you get into Tarleton then?
Well, that is quite a question. The first year, the first 3 years, I never had seen Tarleton.
Your first 3 years out here on the homestead?
And the mister had to go to town one time to borrow money. We had no way of going. So him and one of the other neighbors, George Swanson, and him, they walked to Tarleton to go to the bank.
And that's approximately
17 and a half miles. And they left early in the morning, and they got up the canal bank, took the shortcut, and went in. And all we wanted was just a little bit of money to buy feed for the horses and stuff like that. And we were quite amused. It's comical to think back. They wanted to know what values you had for guarantee, you know, you had to have something to borrow money on. And we just had cheap silverware and stuff, but we had to give it in mortgage. He came home and said, do you know we even had to give our silverware mortgage to borrow $25? And I said, well, just as long as they let us have them so we can eat till we pay the $25 off. Well, we didn't have any crop, absolutely nothing. What little we had, we need to feed, and the range horses would come in and eat you out, you know, which we had to put up with a lot.
Now, you speak of range horses. Did these belong to any particular
Nobody.
Range?
They were running wild. And they'd come in, if you buy a little hay, well, they'd come in the morning, it was gone. And they'd get your crop pretty bad. So there wasn't much crop there. But we were always considered ourselves luckier than most of them, because we could go back to Gearing, and he was known at the sugar factory, and his job was there for him. So he'd work through the campaign, and in the spring we'd come back out again, which we had to do. And so we battled it through, but I would never want any of my children to go through it. I don't think the young generation could take it.
You saw it as a series of hardships. I wonder, you talked about the difficulty in getting water. What were some of the other hardships that you had to face as an early homesteader?
Well, when you got sick, you had no doctors. Tarleton was the closest you could get to it. And I know I was given up as dead, and the doctor came out. They went in and got him. Bill Hall was a homesteader, and he had a little Model T, and he went in and got the doctor. And he came out, and before he left, he met my husband out at the door, and he said, well, she's not going to live till morning. So he says, I want you to pay me now. He says, it's $41. And he said, well, I can give you a check for $41, but I have to get in town. Well, he says, I'll get it. Don't worry about it. Just so I have the check. So he gave him a check for $41. And the next morning, we had Reverend Falcon out here. He came out, he had an old Model T, and they got me in this. Hattie Mae came over and stayed with me. She was a good registered nurse. And they got me in the car and took me down to the depot here. And that was the second year we was out here. And they put me on the express, on the train, and it had on was the baggage car and the caboose. But they put me on a stretcher in the baggage car and got down to Gearing, and we had our doctor down there. They knew me from the time I was a little girl, He was my folks' doctor. And he was right there at the depot and took me to the hospital at Scott's Bluff. But as it turned out, I didn't die, and the doctor got his $41. So I don't know. I thought that was about as bad as anything you could.
Sickness then was a problem you had to contend with. Were there any other particular problems that were worries of a homesteader's wife out here?
Well, yes. Mister was sick one time, and he went to Washington, D.C. And he stayed 3 weeks in the hospital in Washington, D.C., the Veterans Hospital. And I stayed alone. I didn't know how to harness a horse or drive a team, and I did learn later on, but at the time I didn't. So I said, well, I'll be all right, but we have a .45 caliber here. And he said, make sure when you go to bed at night, have that laying by your pillow.
Now, was this in worrying about other people coming in?
Yes, there's so many strangers that you didn't know. And so many times people were all right. I don't think they'd hurt you. But we had so many people that just was just to see what the country was like, people who come through that you never had seen before. And so at least I was kind of uneasy at nights. Other time, the daytime, it didn't bother me. And it was pretty hard then to get my groceries, you know. And I didn't get to town, and the little grocery store at Veteran, you had to have cash or you'd never bought there, you know, unless you just run a big bill and didn't know how to pay it. So Jim Westerwell at Gearing, he said when we got the homestead, I used to work at his store, and he said, now don't you worry, you kids will never go hungry. Whenever you need a grocery, once a month, you make out a list and send it. All you have to have is your 51 cents for your freight to send it. And then this fall, when Herman goes to the sugar factory, well, you pay it off. So we considered ourselves very lucky on that part. And the train by that time came through, and that's what we do. We send once a month our grocery list down, and they'd send it to us. And he says, I don't want you to do what I did when I homesteaded. He said, when I homesteaded in the Gearing Valleys, we used to go out and steal cattle. And butchermen, we'd steal it and divide it up between the homesteaders. But he said, that was years ago. Nowadays, you couldn't get by with that. So he says, and I don't want you to go through that hardship. And so we were fortunate we had that.
Were there any instances of homesteaders in this area stealing some of the cattle on the range?
Not that I know of. There probably were some. But people were, those that came in, they looked out for one another.
What about when you came out here, you mentioned that it was mostly prairie and very little land had been broken out. Did you have any difficulties with the local ranchers of the area?
The ranchers didn't bother us too much. They kept their cattle pretty well. They resented us, very much so. These drylanders that farmed north of the canal, this was paradise to them. You see, there was the Goshen Hole, and whenever there was heavy rains, there'd be a lot of ponds and stuff, and the grass was beautiful, and they just ranged their cattle on that. And then when the homesteaders came in, well, they had to fence their cattle in. And they resented that, but they didn't make any trouble for us. It's just that they let you know that we all got lemons. One day one came to the door and he was checking on his cattle if we had seen any strays. And he said, well, you folks sure got lemons down here, haven't you?
Now, what do you mean, lemons?
Bad land.
I see.
And they called it, you got bad lemon down here. And I said, well, you survived all those years. You came out here in about 1910. And this is 12 years later. I think we'll survive. Now, later on, some of them were anxious to buy land down here.
Ms. Albright, I'm going to turn the tape over now. We're about
to... Oh, this sounds terrible.
Talking about the land then that you came to out in this country, I know today that it's primarily a beet producing area. What about in the first years of your homesteading?
Mostly had grain, just a little grain, and it was all broke out with walking plows. There was nothing farmed in through here. There wasn't a furrow plowed. And so everybody had walk and plow. And then the second year, one man got a tractor and they got a little more. But then mainly it was grain. And then in 26 and 7, they started to raise beets.
Why was it that late that they began to raise them? Was there any particular reason?
We didn't have a beet dump. See, the holly had just come in. They didn't have a beet dump out here. And there was no way we could haul them. And then after we did have the beets, well, we had to haul 4 miles to the dump with a team and wagon. So there weren't too many beets raised. They finally got into corn and barley and beans. And the beets came later then. And after the holly put the beet dump down here, while there was quite a few beets, everybody was glad to get into them because the grain was never too good. And the beans didn't do too good on a lot of that heavy soil.
Now, from the time that you came out here then, the land in this area was under irrigation?
It was all ready to put the ditches in. The ditches were all in the laterals. Then all the farmers had to do was survey their own ditches to get the water, which was easy to do. And then that way they were sure of getting their water.
I think I neglected to ask you, how large was your homestead in acres?
160.
And you had to provide ditches onto that 160 acres?
Well, they had the laterals in. And then all you had to do is plow your ditches in along the edges, along your fields. And I remember the mister had a walking plow, and he plowed them out, and then he scooped them out.
Do you recall any particular problems with irrigation in those early years?
Oh yes, there were a lot of problems. There was always some fellow that wanted a little more water. And if you didn't watch yourself, you'd have a dry ditch and your water would be gone. They'd just take all they could get to flood theirs, you know, and everybody wanted the water. So some people it meant more just the water than anything else. But everybody had enough water, but they'd still at nights you come out and you had a dry ditch, your water was gone. Till they finally put locks on the hip gates.
Did this create some personal conflicts between some of the homesteaders?
Well, yes, it was hard feelings. But they'd get over it, but for a while they'd resent it. You would resent it, you know, when you were busy getting the water. And we didn't raise much crop. We had very little crop. Because it took a long time to plow out a few acres with a walking plow.
Did people continue to come throughout the 1920s into the veteran area?
We had quite a few that came in rented places then. After these homesteaders had proven up, we had quite a few different people that came in and farmed. But they wouldn't last long. They'd be here a year or two and then they'd be gone.
Now, you mentioned, your original home was Montana. Your husband was in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
What about the people who first came out here as homesteaders? Was there any particular area that most of them came from?
Well, Nebraska had quite a few. Around Scott Gearing, there was several that we knew. There was Nels Tart, one of the Thornton boys, and Dr. Brinkley. It was at Scott's Bluff. He had a homestead just 2.5 miles from us. And there were several that I didn't know, but they came from down there. And then I think, there's quite a few from Indiana, Illinois. And so they were just strung all over, you know, they came from different localities.
Was there any particular nationality or ethnic group that was more strongly represented in the Veteran Project?
No, I don't think so. We had a few Jews, and they couldn't take that kind of life at all, you know. That was just out of their line, farming.
Did they more or less stick together, the Jewish people?
Oh, yes.
Were they resented by the other farmers?
No. Everybody got along. It didn't make any difference who they were. You were just glad to see another face.
Well, it almost sounds as if, though, within a short period of time, that this area was pretty well filled with people.
We had a lot more people then than we have now.
You really didn't lack for company then, was that true?
Well, people visit more. Because you'd get in your... get your horses out, and get in the spring wagon, and you'd go and you'd pick up another one and go and visit someone, you know. There'd always be 2-3 families. Of course, there weren't many families, but even the bachelors would all get together and go someplace and visit. And you never felt like any of them were better than you were, or that no grudge against anybody. You just got along fine. And what you have to do when you come into a homesteading area, and most of these homesteads, the biggest was 160, there were quite a few of that, and then we had 120s, we had 80s, and 140s. I don't know why they were cut up that way, but as you look around and study this land, you can see why some of them were cut that way. The railroad goes through, or the canal cut off some. And of course, ours wasn't all irrigated. It was 60 acres of dry north of the canal, because the canal went right through. And it was quite a problem to get over there, because there was no bridge or anything. We had to go a mile to go over and then come back and get ours. So that made 2 miles, you know, to drive around.
Did you live, when you first came to the homestead, did you live in a what we think was a rather typical homestead shack with tar paper and made of boards of maybe 12 by 16?
Oh, yes, there's quite a history on that. When we got ready to come down here, my dad had a little shack in the back of his yard, the house where they lived in, and back in the backyard they had a little shack, but it was just one room, and it was a 12 by 14. And it had nice windows in. We thought we had fancy windows. They were long. And it was too small for just one, so we built a bedroom on it that was 10 by 8, just so we'd get the bed in it. And it was just made out of footboards and the roof tar paper. But we brought it down here, and when the mister moved it down here with a team and wagon, to put it in sections and put it on a hay rack. And my brother-in-law and him, they started out one morning with the hay rack with the shack on it, and with the other wagon they brought furniture, what we could bring, no more than we could put in that space. So we came down, and they came down, and it was a beautiful day. We moved down, just beautiful. And they got as far as Yoder the first night. They stayed at Mr. Finch. That's how he got acquainted there with Mr. Finch. And they stayed overnight there, and then the next morning they came over to the homestead. Now that was 12 miles crossed.
Now, was this before you had come to
before
this area?
Before I came.
They moved the shack before you
They came. Moved the shack. And so they put the shack up. It didn't take long to put it up because it was in sections. And there was just a trail for a road. When they worked on those ditches on the canal and the laterals, all these workmen had just tracks, you know, where they drove back and forth. So they just didn't want to build right on that road, so they built away from it. And of course, they had the number by the homestead to go by. And that evening it was getting sundown, and couple of fellas came back from Torrington and they had an old Model T. And they stopped and they wanted to know if they were lost. And the mister said, no. And they said, well, what unit is this? That's how you went by to find your place. And they said, well, this is 217. And they said, well, we went by here this morning and there wasn't any buildings here.
Well, what was it like living and raising a family in that homestead shack?
Wasn't bad. The inside was some folks had lined it all out with oilcloth. And there was no two-by-fours. Dad had built it and rented out. It was just a straight wall. The two-by-fours were put against flat. And then they insulated and then it lined it with all oilcloth. The whole place was lined that way.
Now this was a two-room shack, your bedroom plus the main room, right?
The bedroom was the main room and then the kitchen was 12 by 14. It was just about the size of this one out here. So it worked out pretty good. And oh, in the summer it got awful hot and in the winter it got awful cold. You couldn't afford to keep the cold stove going all night because fuel was scarce to come by, especially wood. And there's some occasions I'll never forget when the baby would get so dry she'd want a drink, you know, and she had a habit of having a drink at night. Well, one night the mister got up and the dipper was froze in the bucket of water, just solid. And the icicles were hanging down from the ceiling, almost down to the bed. And so he just put on boots and went out the well and got her. That was the second year we homestead, was on the homestead. We had our well then. And he went out the well to get her some drinking water because that inside was so froze.
What did you burn for fuel?
Well, we had coal. We'd go to Lingle and get coal. So he'd go and get coal, and when he'd come across the river, he'd go and pick up wood. Because there was a lot of wood along the river, and he'd pick up for kindling. And he'd dig out trees, then in the spring, he'd dig out a lot of trees along the river, and we set them out. That's how we got our trees started. We had quite a grove of trees over there, which is still there. Them are trees that were brought down from the river.
Now, as you look out across this area now, you'll frequently see groves of trees mm-hmm. at various places. Were there any trees in the early 1920s?
There were none on these. None of these homesteads had trees. They've all been planted. Now, when we bought this tree place here, it had a couple of trees right around the house. And three of them along the ditch that volunteered from the irrigation water, a couple of trees. And then when we bought this place in 43, we set out 2,000 trees. And we watered them with the buckets.
Did you ever have any prairie fires to worry about?
None. Not around here, nobody's ever had prairie fires. And we never had fires till just the last 2-3 years. Some people have fires all the time. I think it's carelessness.
Did you ever see any sod houses around the country? Did anyone ever put up any of those?
There were sod houses here before we came here, and that was west of the Siphon.
But
none of the homesteaders
really put up any sod houses.
Mostly all wood shacks.
Well, you saw life primarily then as a series of hardships. There must have been some fun to homesteading as well.
Oh, yes. We had, the mister always liked baseball so well. And Yoder had established a baseball team. And they had the Marlette boys. You probably heard about that team. They were good players. And we managed to get to those ball games regardless. We had to go in the buggy or anything that was moving. And we had our entertainment. And in those days, people stayed at home more and had more company. You were closer. I think community was closer. And you always felt like, well, a picnic or have the neighbors come in. And that way you always found horseshoe playing or something like that that they entertained themselves with. And the women could always find something to do.
You mentioned, though, that it was 3 years before you saw Torrington. Did you feel a sense of isolation out here? Did it bother you a great deal? Just evidently you must have stayed, as you mentioned, right close to home.
Stayed close at home. It didn't bother me too much because I didn't know any better, I guess. You know, if you have never had anything, it's not hard to get along without it. And we came out here with the intention of staying. And then we left for 4 years. And then we came back. And I never did go much. I came out of town. The mister didn't want to come back on the homestead. He just didn't want it. He wanted to rent places down the valley. And I said, why farm for someone else when we got this? So I had to put up with whatever came because I was the one who persuaded him. Later on, he was glad he didn't come.
Did times get a little better in the late 1920s?
Well, no. We hit the Depression then, you see. We came back then in 29, and then the Depression hit.
Did you come back to your original homestead?
Yes. Came back to the original homestead, and he came down and he built a big basement. And we came down and had the basement to live in. We didn't live in the homestead shack then. And things had changed a lot by then. People had put up different homes and stuff. But then when the Depression hit, it was pretty hard then. And I didn't get to town. We came back out here in Memorial Day. I came back out here. And I had never been in Torrington then till that fall, and I got such a terrible toothache. And we had an old Model T we had bought for that time. And the mister took me in to see a dentist. And we had, Arthur was a little baby then. He was born in April, and this was in October. And he had never been off the place. And when we got into Torrington, we had to stop for a train to go by. And he got hysterical. See that train and whistle, and he just got so hysterical, we thought he was never going to quit crying. We drove up to Doc Hanna's office, and I went in to get my tooth pulled. And he pulled a good tooth. When he got through, he says, my gosh, I pulled the wrong tooth. So the mister was out in the car trying to keep this baby quiet, and the poor kid just got sick because he had never seen a train before. And I came out, and all my face was all swollen and everything. And he said, this wasn't our day to come to town. So I don't know whether you call that hard times or depressing. So we went through a lot, but I think it's that's why I'm staying on the place now, because this is just paradise now compared to what it was.
Now, I understand in the early 1930s, it was extremely dry, dust bowl conditions out mm-hmm. of this country. I wonder if you can recall your recollections of those dry years out here.
Well, there just was nothing. I know most of the drylanders, they had to hang on. Those that did, that hustled, they put out loose thistles for feed. And those that put it up for their milk house, they survived. And those that didn't, the cattle just starved. And they lost everything. And there was quite a few over south that hung on, done that, and they saved their herd. And we didn't have much crop but we went and we had 8 milk cows, and we had our chickens and raised big gardens. I canned 700-800 quarts the stuff, no matter what it was, it went into jars. And that's how we could survive. It wasn't the crop. We lived off of the cream check, what little it was, and the eggs. I remember we took 30 dozens in one time, and the mister had them in the wagon, and they were 6 cents a dozen. When he got in, they were all froze. So we lost that. So we said, well, now we'll have to eat more eggs at home the next time to make a go of it for the next month. But the cream checks made us get through it. We raised enough hay. Every little sprig of grass was mowed and put up. And that way we had our feed for our cattle.
Did you get conditions in which it was almost impossible to get a crop off the land because of the sand?
Well, our land wasn't sandy down here. It was quite heavy. So it was never blowed out. And then at that time we raised beets. See, beets were raised then. And the beets were poor, 5-6 ton, but there was still something to fall back on.
In some parts of the country, they had large dust clouds. In fact, it became so hazy, so dusty, that even the sun was...
Well, we had a few days like that. But really, it wasn't continuous. It wasn't like the eastern part, like Nebraska and Kansas and in through there and Oklahoma. We didn't have those dust storms. But it was just the dry heat that burned everything up.
Just didn't rain, I suppose.
No rain and drought. And by May, the grass was all brown already, which made it bad. And the people that, then late in the fall, then the rain set in. And some of them could get these thistles and cut them, you know, they'll grow if they get a little moisture. So it's just been pretty hard.
When did things begin to get better? For the farmers?
Well, I think in 39 and 40, things were starting to pick up.
Was there any particular reason that you recall times becoming better?
Well, we raised better crops. The land was worked better. See, that sod, it takes time to work it. And then everybody... Well, so many of them went and worked other places and then came back, and then that's the way we did. We'd leave, and we got so we could buy a tractor, so you'd save every cent you possibly could. I'd go to work, and he'd go to work. It wouldn't be a cent spent, and not even buy a dress or anything. In a beauty shop, you didn't know anything about that. And you saved up everything so you could buy a little implement to come out and farm. And everybody got a little more to work with.
Did you share your implements?
People worked together quite a bit. We raised 18 acres of beans one year. We rented the 18 acres. They were just across the road from us over here. And over from the homestead. We put those 18 acres of beans in, and we were hoed them and did them all. And that's why my hands are so big. We pulled those 18 acres by hand.
Then it was customary for the women to work right with the men
right
in the fields.
And you, if you didn't, you just didn't have any chance. And we'd go out early in the morning before they got dry, and we'd pile them, pull them, and put them in rows. And then we bought a little bean combine. They were special bean combine. And some of the neighbors had some beans, and so I fed all of them through by hand. They'd fork them, and then I fed them through the machine. And then when they were all harvested, we had no market for them. So the businessmen in Gearing that knew me that run the grocery stores down there, they said, just get them all down here, we'll buy them from you. And that's what we did. It was the Gearing Mercantile and old Vestawell. They bought them for their two stores. They knew us so well, because I used to work for Jim Vestawell, and they said, you bring your beans down here, we'll have a market for them.
And Mrs. Albrandt, you continued then to stay out in this country, continue to farm, to raise your family. And I think you told me that you had 5 children out here. And I wonder if you mind giving me the names of your children.
Well, we have one daughter, she's the oldest. It's Helen Fry, Mrs. Wayne Fry, and Woodrow Albrand that still lives on the old homestead.
And he continues to farm.
He continues to farm. And then Arthur, he's at Bridgeport. Bridgeport, Nebraska, and he runs a Conifer station down there. He has a bulk station there. And then Roland, he's at Riverton. He has his drugstore up there, his pharmacist. And Calvin's Columbia, Missouri. And he's a professor at the University of Columbia.
I asked you your children because I think it was rather interesting in that you had 5 children. One of them continued to farm, but the other 4 went in rather different occupational directions. One, of course, as you mentioned, is teaching at University of Missouri, Columbia, mm-hmm. and so forth. So I think that's rather interesting. I want to thank you for visiting with me this afternoon about your early recollections.
Probably a lot of things there that you, it isn't of interest to others, but then.
Well, it's been interesting this afternoon visiting with you, and I think it's added a great deal to our knowledge of the veteran area. Again, thank you, Mrs. Albrandt.